You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, time travel is simulated in quantum experiments in the lab.
So there's many effects that are not possible in standard quantum mechanics that then seem to be possible in this time travel situation.
How the Higgs boson, combined with primordial gravitational waves, could destroy the universe.
It would be catastrophic if we ended up in that minimum. The universe wouldn't exist, it would collapse.
FQXI invites you to become a physics filmmaker in our first ever video contest.
Have you ever wondered how scientists know that the universe is expanding? Yeah. Well, today we're going to find out in
Science Geeks!
And could entropy explain why nature chose to play by quantum rules?
But is there even a conceivable world in which these would be different? And do these notions always make sense, and do they always coincide?
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster.
Thank you for listening to the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. That's all we've got time for today, so thank you again to our contributors.
Brendan, stop. What are you doing? Why are you saying goodbye? The podcast has only just started.
Has it? Okay, I guess on your timeline, the podcast has just begun. I've recently got into time travel research, and it's really hard for me to keep track of my temporal coordinates.
I suppose you've been inspired by our first item today, which describes how a team of quantum physicists simulated time travel in the lab.
That's right, I was inspired by that item. I mean, I will be inspired by this item. Tenses are so difficult when you describe time travel. It's all Einstein's fault. It's his general theory of relativity that says that time travel is theoretically possible. According to relativity, space and time are woven together into a fabric that can be curved and bent in such strange ways that it's possible to create closed time-like curves.
Closed time-like curves. Those are paths through space-time that keep taking you back to the space-time point where you started again and again.
Sounds like the story of my life.
Anyway, yes. Closed time-like curves are theoretically possible in general relativity. Although, they do raise some weird paradoxes about time travel, like how you might be able to go back in time and kill your grandfather, thus preventing your own birth. In which case, you wouldn't be able to go back in time and kill your grandfather, if you see what I mean.
I've never understood why people think that if you travel back in time, you'd want to kill your grandfather. Does time travel turn you into a homicidal maniac?
It's a good question. But anyway, in the early 1990s, Oxford physicist David Deutsch showed that closed time-like curves that were set up in quantum experiments and were traversed by quantum particles, such as particles of light or photons, might escape such paradoxes. And it's this kind of scenario, sending a photon back in time and having it interact with its younger self, that researchers at the University of Queensland in Australia have simulated in the lab. Earlier, I chatted with two of the team, Andrew White and Martin Ringbauer, who talked about some of the strange results they found when time travel was combined with quantum mechanics. For example, the presence of closed time-like curves can violate Heisenberg's famous uncertainty principle and also allow you to perfectly copy any quantum state, a task that should be impossible in quantum theory. They also chatted about how such experiments could help physicists who are striving to unite quantum mechanics and general relativity in a single theory of quantum gravity. But first, White began by explaining the physics of closed time-like curves and how they could lead to time travel.
So closed time-like curves are a perfectly legitimate solution in general relativity. And what they are is they're a path or a curve through space-time that comes back to their starting point. So if you set forward on this path on a closed time-like curve, you'll come back around to where you set out from. And so the closed means that you come back to where you started. And the time-like means that you're basically travelling through time.
Einstein's theory of gravity, general relativity, says that space and time are stitched together to form a four-dimensional fabric, which can be bent and warped in bizarre ways. As White explains, the equations of general relativity tell you that this fabric could, in theory, create closed time-like curves in certain exotic situations.
It's allowed in general relativity in a set of fairly artificial situations. So the first solution was found, I think, in 1949 by Gödel, and that one, I think, was a massless rotating universe, which doesn't really correspond to anything like the world we live in. Mm-hmm. People have found other solutions then where they can generate these curves, but they always involve strong relativistic effects and rotation.
Although time travel appears to be theoretically possible, it raises paradoxes that are beloved of science fiction writers.
So they're allowed by general relativity. There's no physical principle that rules them out within general relativity. But of course, that has led to questions from people because they seem to allow, therefore, things like the grandfather paradox, grandparent paradox, where you could go back in time, kill one of your grandparents, thus preventing your parents from being born, thus preventing you from being born. But then on the other hand, who built the time machine to go back in time and kill them? And so it goes. So there's consistency issues, at least logically, with them.
In the 1990s, however, physicist David Deutsch at the University of Oxford wrote a paper suggesting that the grandfather paradox might be sidestepped if closed time-like curves were created in a quantum setting. A crucial property of quantum particles is that they can be in superpositions, in which they exist in two or more different states at the same time. Before being observed, for example, a particle can be in a superposition of two places at the same time. And in a time travel scenario, it is possible that a quantum particle could exist in a superposition of two states that are equivalent to both going back in time and killing your grandfather and not killing your grandfather. David Deutsch interpreted this in terms of parallel universes. He suggested that this superposition corresponded to the creation of two separate realities, one in which you kill your grandfather and one in which you did not. That way, even if your temporal travels result in the untimely demise of one of your ancestors, you would not immediately pop out of existence. Instead, you would simply slip into a parallel reality. Team member Martin Ringbauer explains.
But now in the quantum case, quantum systems cannot only exist in two states, like either you go back in time or you don't go back in time. But in a quantum case, you have mixed states as well in superpositions. So what happens is that the quantum system would be in a state of existing and non-existing, in a mixture of those two states. Therefore, you also have a mixture of killing your grandfather and not killing him. And Deutsch actually interpreted that in terms of the many worlds interpretation, where he said, when there is an encounter with the older version, then these two things could happen. So either you kill this older version, then you move into a different universe and you don't exist anymore in the universe where this grandfather was killed, you move into another universe. Or the other version is where you don't kill the grandfather and then two copies exist in this universe.
Right, I see. Okay, that's very science fiction-y.
But from a mathematical point of view, you can formulate it in a consistent way, and that's why we got interested in it.
The team used two photons, or particles of light, to mimic the effect of time travel in the lab. One photon played the part of the younger version of the time traveller. The other photon played the role of the older version of the time traveller.
Yes, well, we certainly don't have any wormholes in our lab. What we did is we used the second photon to play the role of the past incarnation of the time-traveling photon. So in that way, we had two photons in our simulation. One of them was the older version, one of them was the younger version. Then they interacted, and then we looked at the outcome and the behavior of this one photon.
The team wanted to know what would happen if the older and younger selves met and interacted. Mathematical calculations showed that this scenario is theoretically equivalent to one that is a little bit easier to simulate in the lab, in which one photon travels through normal space-time, but then interacts with another photon that is trapped in a closed time-like curve. The trick was then to simulate the closed time-like curve in the lab. Deutsch's original theoretical work explained how the state of a photon would be affected if it went through a closed time-like curve. Using this information, the team prepared one photon in the state that it would have had if it had been trapped in a closed time-like curve, and then watched what happened when it interacted with an arbitrary photon.
So photon one can be completely arbitrary, and that's also what we do. We prepare many different states for photon one and try different interactions, but the theory tells us how the photon in the closed time-like curve would look like, and we use this information to prepare it in that way and then see what this does to photon one when it interacts with this closed time-like curve.
It turns out that time travel creates some strange outcomes. Things that would otherwise be forbidden in quantum mechanics suddenly become possible. For instance, the quantum world is inherently uncertain. In fact, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle states that you cannot ever measure certain pairs of properties with perfect precision. That changes when a photon has been through a closed time-like curve, or a CTC, as Ringbauer calls them.
What we see is that the rules of standard quantum mechanics change. So there's many effects that are not possible in standard quantum mechanics that then seem to be possible in this time travel situation. One example is we see that you can perfectly distinguish quantum states, non-orthogonal quantum states, which is something that is just impossible in normal quantum mechanics. Because in standard quantum mechanics, you can only perfectly distinguish orthogonal quantum states, so like horizontal and vertical polarization. Now, when there is a CTC involved, this nonlinear evolution enables you to actually perfectly distinguish any two quantum states by just using the right interaction.
Another quantum rule that goes flying out of the window when time travel comes into play is quantum non-cloning, which states that you cannot perfectly copy any quantum state. This calls into question the security of quantum cryptography, a technique for transferring information which is supposed to be unhackable, because any attempt made by an eavesdropper to copy a quantum encryption key would immediately disturb the system and set off alarm bells.
So that's a result that has been known for a couple of years. You can, if you have a closed time-like curve, you can perfectly clone any quantum state, which is not possible in quantum mechanics, and which is on the basis of many effects in quantum mechanics, many applications such as quantum cryptography, which is basically based on the fact that if two parties are sending a secret key between each other, then an eavesdropper cannot copy this key without destroying the key itself and then therefore revealing that it was copied. That's the basis of the security of quantum cryptography. Now, with a closed time-like curve, copying of quantum states becomes possible, which automatically then implies that the security of quantum cryptography would be broken.
Is there an easy way or an intuitive way to understand why a closed time-like curve would allow copying?
It's very related to the distinguishing of the quantum states. You can, in quantum mechanics, clone orthogonal states. You can, for example, clone the states horizontal polarization or vertical polarization. But what you cannot clone is any superposition or anything in between, because the states horizontal and vertical are completely classical if there is nothing else. And now, if you can have nonlinear evolutions that transform some non-orthogonal states to orthogonal states, that helps you clone them. And that just allows you to do a few more things that are forbidden in standard quantum mechanics.
So it sounds like the weird things that we associate with quantum mechanics, some of these are actually made slightly less weird when you put time travel into the mix. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it might get even more weird. So there's a lot of effects happening that should be impossible according to our current theories. that might just show us that we don't really understand what happens to quantum mechanics once strong relativistic effects come into play.
You know, is this type of analysis and these experiments, could they help people who are looking for a theory of quantum gravity in some way?
Well, it certainly points out what happens if you apply our current theory of quantum mechanics in a region of extreme gravitational effects. And there's very little we know about this interface between general relativity and quantum mechanics. So there's a lot of work to do, and we certainly hope that our study gives some insights and some hints as to where you could look for changes and look to find unification.
Thank you to Andrew White and Martin Ringbauer for chatting with Zia there. Although they haven't built an actual time machine in the lab, my TARDIS and I can confirm that in the future, time travel will be possible. Oh wait, I shouldn't have said that. Forget you heard it. There's a link to the Australian team's paper, which appeared in Nature Communications, on the podcast page www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
Now, we're traveling back in time to revisit some of the biggest physics stories of the past few years. The first is the discovery of the Higgs boson at the Large Hadron Collider from a couple of years ago. The second is the announcement that physicists had detected the first evidence of primordial gravitational waves, ripples in the fabric of space-time, from our very early universe soon after the Big Bang, using the BICEP 2 telescope. That, in turn, provided strong support for the theory that our early universe went through a rapid phase of faster-than-light inflation. Both of these discoveries have been in the news again.
That's right. Starting with the Higgs, at the time of the 2012 announcement, LHC physicists were careful to state that the particle they discovered was Higgs-like. Since then, they have been doing follow-up studies to try to pin down its precise nature. The Higgs only has a short lifetime before it decays into other particles. And so particle physicists must look at those decay products and from them infer whether they came from a Higgs. In June, the CMS collaboration at the LHC published a paper in Nature Physics saying that they have found the first evidence of a direct decay of the Higgs into certain types of particles called fermions. This matches the predictions for a Higgs boson with a mass of around 125 GeV.
All of which is good news for the LHC. They are continuing to find evidence that the particle they originally thought was the Higgs probably is the Higgs. Things haven't been quite as rosy for the BICEP 2 team, who announced the discovery of primordial gravitational waves in March, however.
No, if you go back to the May podcast, we heard from cosmologists André Linde and João Magalhães, who both urged caution that these were early days and more work was needed to confirm that the signal that was seen really was due to primordial gravitational waves. Magalhães, in particular, was worried that the signal might actually have been caused by contamination from dust in our galaxy, which could mimic the same effect.
I actually met up with cosmologist Alan Guth, one of the founders of inflation theory, at MIT in May, and we talked about his excitement at first hearing the news from BICEP 2, but we also talked about some of the controversy around the origin of the signal, possibly its origin from dust, that was growing at that time. Here's what he had to say.
I was certainly elated when I heard the news. I learned about it first, actually, from an email from John Kovac, who was initially somewhat cryptic. This was a week before the official announcement. The next day, he visited me at MIT and showed me a copy of the paper and told me about the results. And I was very impressed that they had found a very strong result, 5 sigma in the language that these people use, which means that the probability of it happening by random coincidence is less than 1 in a million. So I was incredibly elated and continued to be very excited. But since the original announcement, actually things have taken a bit of a turn as other groups have started to look more carefully at the analysis. And the 5 sigma is still valid for whether or not they've seen something. But there's a serious question about whether or not they've seen real primordial gravitational waves or whether they've seen a spurious effect due to dust in the foreground. So I think we have to wait and see. I still think it's more likely than not that the result will hold up, but now I think it's hard to tell, and it will certainly be a great relief if other groups can come in and confirm the result that BICEP2 found.
That was Alan Guth. We also spoke in more detail about the implications if the BICEP2 result does stand up, and you can hear more of that interview on the podcast page www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
The BICEP2 team has now published their results in the journal Physical Review Letters, and while they stand by their result, they do allow that it is possible that the result is due to dust. So once again, it's a case of wait and see. In particular, cosmologists will be waiting to see if independent data from the Planck satellite, due to be released in a few months, provides corroboration.
But in the meantime, Brendan, let me ask you, what do you get if you cross the BICEP2 results with the Higgs boson?
Is this a joke? Because the setup's not that strong.
The answer is, the universe would be destroyed.
It's not the best punchline I've heard either. I'm not sure I get it.
That's because it's not a joke, Brendan. That's the conclusion of a new analysis by Malcolm Fairbairn and Robert Hogan of King's College London in the UK, who have analysed the possible fate for our universe if both those results are true. It turns out that the Higgs field, which pervades the universe, is likely to be found in one of two possible states. The one we are in, which is hospitable for life, and another one that is decidedly less so. And if the BICEP2 results stand, they've calculated that the universe should be in the far less friendly version, which is prone to destruction, as Fairbairn explained to me earlier. Now, your latest piece of research brings together two of the biggest kind of announcements in physics of the past few years. The first being the discovery of the Higgs boson at the LHC at CERN, and the other being the recent announcement a couple of months back that the BICEP2 telescope had discovered evidence of primordial gravitational waves that lend support to the idea that our universe went through a period of inflation in its early history. So you came up with quite a strange result when you put the two of these results together. So can you just tell us what the result was that you found?
If the universe went through a period of inflation as rapid as the one which would explain the BICEP2 observations, then the universe would have collapsed. Of course, the universe hasn't collapsed because we're still here. So that means there has to be some new physics, which we kind of knew had to be there anyway. But this is almost like a confirmation. There has to be some new physics. So we're not just wasting our time trying to find it.
So let's talk a bit about, you know, the first element of that, the Higgs boson and the Higgs field. So can you explain why it is that the Higgs field has any impact at all on what happens in the universe? So it's kind of, it's this field that's pervading the universe. And I guess we're talking about the different values of energy that this field can take.
Yeah, it's got a different field value. So, I mean, normally when you talk about a magnetic field, you've got a magnitude and a direction because that's sort of like a vector field. But the Higgs field is a scalar field, so it just has a magnitude. The value of that field throughout the universe is 246 GeV, where GeV are particle physics units, giga electron volts. And that sets the mass of all the particles in the universe. And the reason why it's 246 GeV is because there's a minimum in the potential energy for the Higgs at 246 GeV. So it likes to sit there in its potential minimum. But if you look at the quantum corrections to that potential for the Higgs, in particular the quantum effect of the top quark, virtual top quarks and their effect on the Higgs potential, they render the potential unstable at high values. So there should be a second minimum at very, very high values, much, much higher, like 100 million GeV.
So that when we look at the Higgs field using the data that we got from the LHC,
yeah,
there are these two kind of stable minima or stable kind of states for the universe.
It's not really clear if the second one's stable, but it's there. It depends on the parameters. But yeah, there isn't just one minimum.
And we're in the one that is, you know, hospitable for life, and we're very pleased about that.
Yeah, and nice and stable. Yes, exactly, exactly.
And we're obviously not in the other one.
No. And because the minimum we're currently in has got an energy density which is only very, very slightly larger than zero, and that energy density is what we call the dark energy, and it's responsible for the gentle acceleration of the universe. We don't know exactly why it's so close to zero and why it's positive, but we know that it is very close to zero and it is positive. The second minimum, the energy density, is certainly going to be a lot more negative than that, and it'll be negative. So if you were to go into the second minimum, you wouldn't have to worry about the fact that particle physics are different, because presumably it would be so negative it would make the universe collapse. So a negative energy density filling the universe would presumably make the universe collapse pretty quickly. It would be catastrophic if we ended up in that minimum. The universe wouldn't exist. It would collapse.
But as part of your analysis, you've kind of discovered that if you take things very naively in terms of the results that we've got, and we don't assume that there's any other sort of particles that we haven't yet discovered, we should actually be in the other minimum, in which case we wouldn't exist.
Because, I mean, BICEP2, it not only sort of gives weight to inflation, it gives weight to a particular kind of inflation, where the universe was expanding not just very quickly, but very, very, very quickly. So it tells you that the energy density of the universe during inflation was very large. And if we went through a period of inflation with such a large energy density, with such a rapid inflation, there would have been quantum fluctuations of all the fields in the universe, including the Higgs field. And we've calculated that that would definitely have pushed you into the second minimum over the top. So if that happens anywhere, then, you know, the entire universe will collapse. So we can tell there has to be something that stops that from happening.
The BICEP2 results are obviously under a lot of scrutiny at the moment, and we're waiting for data from the Planck satellite to see exactly what it is we currently know about, you know, whether these primordial gravitational waves have been detected and what they do tell us about inflation. But assuming, you know, that that result stands, as was sort of announced, you know, some weeks ago, and assuming that the Higgs results are correct, and we've had a little bit more evidence, I guess, in the past few weeks too, that, you know, people at CERN are more and more convinced that they have seen, you know, the Higgs boson that they thought they'd seen.
Mm.
You know, where does that leave us? Because as you say, you know, the universe hasn't collapsed, we're here. So, you know, how do we get out of this kind of conundrum?
Well, it's not really such a conundrum. I mean, people will come along and they'll say, well, of course, that the idea that the standard model of particle physics is the only thing that's going to be there all the way up to the Planck scale, and there'll be nothing else. I don't think anybody really believes that anyway. It's just because we need, you know, we need to explain the dark matter. We need to explain why there's more matter than antimatter. We need to explain where neutrinos get their masses from. And then there could be a bunch of junk at high energies that doesn't do anything at all, but it's just there. So it's almost arrogant to imagine that there isn't any new physics. It's just that these two results, if they both stand, well, the LHC one's certainly very reliable. The BICEP2 one's obviously under quite a lot of scrutiny at the moment. But assuming they're to both stand, you have some real, genuine information saying, well, yes, there has to be some new physics. Either, you know, there has to be a coupling between the Higgs and the inflaton. There has to be, or some new field which comes in at high energy, which changes the quantum running of the Higgs potential, which would stop the second minimum from existing. So really, this might be the only way that we get information about very high energies, because the energy at which new physics has to come in to stop this second vacuum from occurring, it could be 100 million GeV. And, you know, we're not going to build a detector, a particle accelerator with that center of mass energy for many, many, you know, we might never do it. It's something that's technologically very, very distant for our civilization. So by using these different pieces of information, we can, in principle, learn about energy scales that we're never going to be able to build colliders to investigate.
That was Malcolm Fairburn talking with Zia. So either the BICEP2 result is wrong, the Higgs result is wrong, or we need new physics to explain why our universe hasn't already been crunched down. Is that right?
Yeah, that's about right.
May I offer an alternative proposal? The universe has already been destroyed and we're all dead.
No, Brendan, I think you may not offer that proposal.
Oh, fine. But you know, here at FQXI, we try to reward novel and fun ways of thinking about physics. In fact, FQXI is pleased to announce our first video contest titled Show Me the Physics, which is currently up and running. This is your chance to have a go at movie making and possibly win up to $10,000. The winning videos may even be featured on the Scientific American website.
Tell us more, Brendan. Who can enter the contest?
Well, as always, our contests are open to everyone. In this case, we're welcoming entrants of all ages, kids or professors, students, physics fanatics, basically anyone. We'll even have a special prize for the best entry from a school group.
And what sort of videos are we looking for?
Well, surprise us. Use your imagination and have fun. You could record an experiment being carried out, explain a piece of everyday physics you see on the street. You could describe complex multidimensional mathematics. As long as it's about physics and suitable for a general audience, we want to see it.
Could it be a work of fiction?
Yes.
Animation?
Yes. Or a live-action interview, a mini-documentary, a film spoof, or a musical video. You could even film your pets exploring physics. It can be short or feature-length.
Although a word of warning there, if it is a 3.5-hour epic, we can't promise that the judges will watch it all the way through.
No. So we'd recommend that you keep it to less than 5 or 10 minutes, but that's not a strict rule.
And what sort of equipment should entrants use to record their masterpieces?
Anything you have. We'll accept entries filmed on phones or fancy industry-level cameras or anything in between. We're going to be looking for engaging and correct physics content, imaginatively conveyed, and we're less worried about technical filmmaking ability.
And how will the contest be judged?
Well, those of you familiar with our annual essay contests will know that we encourage the public, other entrants, and members of FQXI to rate the entries and provide positive feedback in our contest forums. The same will be true here. The finalists will be chosen based on a combination of these votes, and an expert panel will decide on the winners. The deadline for submissions is August 8th, but it's always worth entering early to try to raise the votes.
You can also get updates about the contest on Twitter, at FQXI. But for more detailed information, make sure you visit the website www.fqxi.org/community/contests. There you'll see an introductory video, some early entries, and of course, the full rules.
Rules, rules, rules. You know, sometimes I wonder why we have to obey so many rules.
Because otherwise there'd be anarchy, Brendan.
No, but not just us. Why does nature obey specific rules of physics? Especially the truly odd ones. For instance, quantum theory. Can anybody explain to me why nature follows spooky quantum laws rather than others that are less spooky? Or even more spooky? Why? Why? Why?
That's actually a question that physicists John Barrett at the University of Oxford and Matt Leifer at the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario, have been investigating. Although in a slightly less melodramatic way. They've been studying alternative theories to quantum mechanics and trying to find out what makes quantum theory the most suitable for our universe, rather than one of its rivals. Reporter Colin Stewart spoke with Barrett and Leifer and found that the answer may lie in a slightly unexpected place. Thermodynamics.
Every undergraduate is familiar with thermodynamic entropy, a concept intimately wrapped up with the infamous second law of thermodynamics. However, it isn't the only form of entropy physicists grapple with. Funded by a recent FQXI grant, John Barrett of the University of Oxford and Matt Leifer from the Perimeter Institute in Ontario hope to dig deeper into our understanding of the quantum world by comparing and contrasting the two. Leifer sets the scene.
So there are these two concepts of information entropy that we encounter in physics. One is in the context of thermodynamics, where we have the notion of entropy, which quantifies roughly the amount of heat that must be dissipated to perform some process, such as to perform work on a system. And then we also have the notion of information entropy, which comes from Shannon theory, which roughly speaking quantifies how much redundancy is there in some message. So if I have a message that's, say, n bits long, can I get away with sending you fewer bits and you'll still be able to reconstruct that message? There's this curious coincidence that these two things are the same. So in all physical theories that we know about, the mathematical formula for computing these two quantities is always the same. And so there's been a lot of debate about whether thermodynamic entropy literally is information theoretic entropy. And so our grant is really about investigating this question in the context of arbitrary physical theories. So we know that these things are the same in the theories that we know about, in the theories that describe our world. But is there even a conceivable world in which these would be different? And do these notions always make sense, and do they always coincide in every physical theory you can imagine?
I asked Barrett to explain what they mean by arbitrary physical theories and how they might help to see if the two kinds of entropy really are the same.
Over the past few years, there's been a lot of work where people look at what we're calling generalized probabilistic theories. The idea is that you sort of think of both classical probability theory and quantum theory just as two points in a sort of large space of possible theories that you can at least write down, although most of them would have nothing to do with nature. You know, as far as we know, it's quantum theory that describes nature. But nonetheless, you can write down different models or theories. In some work that Matt and I did a few years ago, we investigated the concept of entropy as you might define it in different probabilistic theories. And we were really just focusing on information theoretic entropy, not on the thermodynamic kind. What emerged is that you can posit various sort of natural definitions, but the quantum case is more special because it turns out that all these definitions coincide and give you the usual quantum entropy, which we call the von Neumann entropy. So what we'd like to do now is think more about this, and in particular to think about the concept of thermodynamic entropy as it might be defined in different sorts of theories or models, and to see in each case what relationship it might have with different notions of information theoretic entropy. The idea is really that we can explore what the relationship between these two concepts is by looking at these two concepts, not just in the context of quantum theory and classical statistical theories, but in this much wider space of general theories, and hopefully that way to understand much better conceptually what the relationship between these concepts is.
Curious to see why they were keen to explore theories that don't currently reflect our working view of nature, I asked Lifa whether there was anything else to gain from exploring these alternative setups.
Well, of course, it doesn't describe the physics of the world as we know it right now, but quantum theory may not be the ultimate theory of reality. So we are looking at theories which, you know, go beyond that in some sense. So I guess, I mean, this is a bit of a cliche in the field, but in quantum gravity, we don't know what the ultimate theory is going to be. So one could imagine that one possible axiom for such a theory would be the idea that these two kinds of entropy should be the same. And one could also imagine schemes that promote the second law of thermodynamics to an axiom. So if you're looking in the space of all conceivable theories, then the idea that there should be these connections between different notions of information could give you some insight into what that theory must look like. So, I mean, there are kind of two aspects to this. One is just the sort of conceptual question. You can think of it as a philosophical question, if you like, which is just, is there a sort of conceivable, logically possible world in which these two things become separate? And the other is that if you believe that these two things should be the same, then that gives you a guiding principle as to how to construct theories.
Even if it turns out that the quantum world is the right picture, Barrett and Leifer's work provide a deeper physical understanding of reality.
You can open any textbook and see quantum theory derived from some number of axioms, but those axioms are just mathematical things setting out the formalism. There'll be things like a system is associated with a complex Hilbert space, the state of a system is a density operator acting on the Hilbert space. So these are just sort of mathematical statements. The idea, both here and also in the other work in recent years, has been to try and derive the theory from postulates that are not just purely mathematical in tone, but somehow compelling postulates, which were either directly physical in character, like the second law, or perhaps sort of information theoretic in character, postulates to do with information and how we can manipulate it.
And could the second law be key to that?
Yeah, promote the second law to some kind of postulate. no doubt one or two other postulates will be required as well. And then see, can we make it so that quantum theory is the unique thing that satisfies these postulates? The model in some ways for all this is Einstein's approach to special relativity in 1905. You know, by that stage, they already had quite a few details of the formalism of special relativity. Lorentz had written down the Lorentz transformations. Somehow Einstein made this great step forwards when he came up with just two postulates, which were speed of light being independent of the source and laws of physics the same in all inertial frames, and then sort of showed that everything else followed from this. And suddenly it looked like a sort of unified theory. And of course, this led to much greater things. It's very hard to see how anyone might have been led along the path to general relativity without seeing special relativity in this way first.
So Barrett and Leifer's FQXI-funded research could give a clearer picture on the similarity and differences between the two kinds of entropy. But by examining the landscape of generalized probability theories, they could uncover valuable clues to which theory should replace quantum mechanics should it ever be shown to break, while simultaneously putting it on a more physical platform if it doesn't.
Thank you to John Barrett and Matt Leifer, who are speaking with Colin Stewart. You can read more about their research on the website www.fqxi.org/community.
I guess the real question is, if I jump into my TARDIS, could I travel through a closed time-like curve and end up back in time in a parallel reality in which I killed my grandfather, but where a different generalized probability theory that does not obey the second law of thermodynamics applies?
That would be an excellent question, Brendan, if you had a TARDIS.
Which, of course, I don't. At least not in your timeline. Yet. That really is all we have time for today.
So thank you again to Andrew White, Martin Ringbauer, Alan Guth, Malcolm Fairbairn, John Barrett, Matt Leifer, and Colin Stewart. He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali. So in your timeline, have you reached the part where the U.S. soccer team has won the World Cup yet?